everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's April 2024, and this is episode 389, which is a discussion about the book, The Exvangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church by Sarah McCammon. Today's guest is Anne Kennedy. She has an MDiv and is the author of Nailed It, 365 Readings for Angry or Worn Out People, and blogs about current events and theological trends at standfirminfaith.com and on her Substack, Demotivations with Anne. She also has a bi-monthly column at the Christian Research Journal, which is called Theological Trends. Anne has written a book review called Fear, Loathing, and Deconverting from the White Evangelical Church, a review of the Exvangelicals by Sarah McCammon. You can read her review for free at our website, equip.org. That's EQUIP.org. Anne, it's good to have you on the podcast.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, as I mentioned, today we're talking about a brand new release from Sarah McCammon, and this book is called The Exvangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. And this idea of exvangelical, before we even get started about the author, it's kind of a new word, and it's linked a little bit to the idea of deconversion. But when we talk about exvangelical, just really quickly before we talk about Sarah, what do people mean when they use that word?
It's been around for a little bit. She has a whole chapter on Jamar Tisby's Leave Loud campaign. Essentially, a little bit before, probably around the campaign season for the election in 2016, people began to feel uncomfortable about their evangelical roots. And the term was coined on a podcast, I think, by Blake Chastain. I think it began before that with the Emergent Church and Rachel Held Evans, the sort of idea of deconstructing. But the term was coined, and it really took off. It's people who grew up in evangelicalism, and they may or may not still identify as Christian. They may, some, you know, may go to sort of more liberal, Protestant liberal or liturgical churches. Although those people that go to, you know, say just a more liturgical tradition that might be conservative would probably not call themselves exvangelical. I haven't really encountered that. But people who were once in the Christian sort of milieu, they probably grew up that way, but no longer identify as Christian, certainly not as an evangelical. They've coined the term exvangelical to be a sort of a rallying cry, I think, to try to find each other online, to kind of have a counter movement, I think, in some ways, be able to have some political weight, I think, contrary to where most evangelicals might find their political leanings. And mainly, I think, to be able to find each other and to have more connection and more visibility in the sort of Christian spaces, I think, like Twitter. And so I think it's gaining steam. There's books like David Gushee's After Evangelicalism, other books like that, and lots of podcasts and articles about what it's like to deconstruct and leave whatever evangelicalism is and how people have seen it through especially the last 50 years.
We're not going to cover David Gushee in this podcast, but in case our listeners were wondering, he is a theologian who really rethought some of his faith based on a family member's coming out. And so his journey really has to do with LGBTQ issues. But I want to ask you specifically about this book and its author. Now, who is Sarah McCammon and why did she write this book?
Sarah McCammon is a correspondent for NPR, and she was assigned in 2016, or I guess probably 2015, to cover the election, specifically of Trump. And so she was often in the press pool, and she, you know, traveled around after him as he went up and down on his campaign. And so she was often in contact with evangelicals, crowds of evangelicals. And as a result of that and her experience on that campaign, she felt uniquely positioned to cover him at that point because she did grow up as an evangelical. Her parents are in are still Christian. And so she, I think, in the way that many people have been able to sort of join biography or memoir with, you know, history in the making and political journalism, she has been able to sort of, she says, have a window on what many people who are enthused about Trump, how they think, what motivates them. The book is really a tell-all kind of an explanation for more of an NPR audience about what an evangelical is, how that person might think, what how they view the world, what their theology and spiritual sense is. And so she explains a lot of things that if you're an evangelical, you wouldn't need her to explain to you. She fills in some definitional gaps and that kind of thing. But she grew up in Kansas City. She went to a Christian school and a Christian college. Her parents were really involved in church. They would stand outside abortion clinics. They were really devoted to their faith and their life, and a little bit activist. And as a result, they don't have a good relationship with their NPR daughter at this point, it sounds like. So she's a journalist now, but she has the background that many evangelicals have.
Now, before we get into what exactly she left and rejected her Christian upbringing, it seems maybe too basic, but I don't want to presuppose that anyone listening to this is clear on what evangelicalism is, or Christianity for that matter, because that term has taken on a lot of different meanings, specifically because of the press. You noted that she works for NPR, which is a media outlet and a secular mainstream media outlet. And so why don't you tell our listeners, when we are using the term evangelical or Christian, this is what we mean. This is what we believe about the Bible and what it teaches, what a Christian means. Because I think too much, when you mentioned Donald Trump, has been linked to politics. And I want to separate that apart from, you know, the label that media has given Christianity because of politics. So when you're saying evangelicals and what they believe, what do you mean exactly?
Right. Well, it is, as you said, it's a term that carries a lot of water. Some of it's not probably legitimate water that it carries, but it is a broadly recognizable term and one that I think we haven't found a good replacement for. So I'm comfortable still using it. It refers to probably more lower church, Protestant, biblically Orthodox, so not mainline Protestant religion in the United States, Christianity in the United States. Although my denomination, I'm an Anglican, we have a long, rich history of British evangelicalism that is part of our heritage. So it began as a movement whereby, you know, many Christians in the West began to really feel they needed to share their faith, they needed to share the substance of the gospel with others around the world. It brought about a really deep and long continuing missionary tradition around the world of missionaries from the U.S. and England who travel and who devote their lives to spreading the good news of Jesus abroad. You can define it theologically. Many have. Some have tried to make it more of a political or an economic or a sort of consumerist term based on what evangelicals in America, what kind of media they like or what kind of products they buy. But I would say that it is a recognizable sort of chunk of people who believe, accept the gospel. It's across denominational lines. So people might disagree about and the end times, infant baptism, you know, some of the more entrenched, longstanding divisions that Christians have had for many generations. And yet, because they have a view of the saving work of Jesus and the necessity of sharing that broadly across the world, they would find common cause with each other and be able to worship together and do many things in common and share a certain cultural kind of cachet or worldview together. So, and of course, yes, what a Christian is somebody, I would say, and it's interesting that we have to delineate this because in the book, she doesn't really get into it, actually. But a Christian is somebody that I would say who has accepted in a trusting sense the news about Jesus on the cross, that he came as our substitute, that he lived, died, rose again, and ascended into heaven. And a person who believes that is a Christian. And I would add some things, like you should be baptized and you should probably go to church if you can. I mean, there's a lot of debate about that kind of thing now, but it's somebody who is within the recognizable fold of the church, largely, but also has a personal saving relationship with Jesus. And so somebody who doesn't have that, who might still call themselves a Christian, but they don't believe that Jesus was God, they don't believe in the resurrection of the dead, that person might claim to be a Christian, but I would say they're not really what we might call a Christian. Those are at least there are more, but those are at least the most important elements of Christian faith and practice and belief.
And I would add onto that, those who hold to that across traditions would believe that the Bible is God's word and it can be trusted. It's not full of myths. And also that the reason why they need to have faith in Christ who is God is because they have sins from which they need to be redeemed. And so the view of man and Christian anthropology is not how most people who are not religious would see the world. They would think that people don't have sins, that they're basically good people and they can do good things to right themselves with God, and would definitely believe maybe in humanity of Christ, but not in his divinity. And we've talked about that before because I've asked you about some of the various different people who are in stages of evolving in their faith or in stages of deconversion from traditional historic Orthodox Christianity. So those are all kinds of issues that maybe people don't realize what Christians are talking about when they say the word evangelical, because it's been tied so much to politics, unfortunately. And so into this kind of, you know, definition and what she grew up, she decides to leave the faith that she grew up in her parents. So what catalyzed her leaving evangelicalism?
Well, as you work through the book, you can see that she's a kind of a willful person. And she struggled, it seems, through her childhood with some of the, not necessarily to the teachings, but probably the packages in which they were delivered. She wanted to be a good Christian. She wanted to believe, I think, as a child. But she was always curious about things like evolution. And, you know, why the catalyst was really her grandfather, who she and her siblings and parents did have a relationship with him, but it was strained. They didn't see him often, and they prayed for him every night that he would be saved, really faithfully prayed for him. And she did also as a child. And she knew that something was wrong, but she really didn't know what it was. And as other, you know, things, she really struggled with the idea that she needed to share her faith with other people so that they could be saved. That was something that troubled her as a child. She felt a lot of guilt about that. And she didn't do a good job. So I think she felt guilt about not doing a good job of, you know, evangelizing. And then at some point in her teenage years, she discovered that her grandfather was gay, that he was in a relationship with another man. And that sort of began, along with a few other sort of experiences that she had, to gradually unwind things or unravel them. She just didn't understand why her parents would believe that her grandfather was going to go to hell because he wasn't a Christian or he wasn't saved or he was in a gay relationship. And so that was the catalyst, I think, discovering that. And then, I mean, she did go on and go to a Christian college, but because I think she wasn't a believer at any point, even though she was trying to be that way, I think it was really kind of easy for her to let go. And she took a journalism degree and eventually got a job with NPR and left the church behind. I guess she was sort of Episcopalian at some point, maybe along the way. But it was the desire to be reconciled to her grandfather and to accept him and not to have an emotional disconnect from him, and also feeling angry with her parents that they kept him at arm's length, that really slowly worked itself in and undid the structure and the fabric of the faith that she had been exposed to as a child. And I think also, as you read through, it's sort of between the lines. She did have a very strained relationship with her parents. She had a hard time with them. And so I think it was, you know, she was probably really needy for affection and affirmation, which did come to her through her grandfather. And so she repaired that relationship with him, and they, before he died, they were very much on the same page. She became affirming of the LGBTQ acronym and him in particular. And that's what brought about essentially her deconstruction. It had many other factors though. I mean, it involved science. She kind of goes through the book. She goes through all the different elements of her cultural evangelical life that she gradually untangled and let go of.
I hope you've been enjoying this conversation with Ann Kennedy about the hot off the press book by NPR reporter Sarah McCammon, The Exvangelicals. And it's this kind of content that we want to bring to you, where we do kind of address quickly some of the theological trends, the hottest new books that have been released, or movies, or television series that everyone's talking about. And we'd like you to partner with us, because the content that we have now is completely free of charge. We have no longer a subscription, paid subscription in any way, not to the website, not to a print magazine. It's totally free. But we'd ask that you would consider giving us a tip, partnering with us in a bunch of different ways. You can easily give us a tip if you go to our website, equip.org. If you click on journal, you will see there's different categories. One is Postmodern Realities Podcast. If you go to any landing page of any of the episodes, you will find a link where you can give us a tip. Plus, really, just giving us a review on Apple Podcasts is so important, because the algorithm really favors the more reviews something has. They think people are talking about it and they suggest it to other people. And we don't have a ton of reviews. We'd love to have more. We know that a lot of people are listening and we know you're really busy. So if you could give us the gift of your time and leave us a review, especially a review that's written on Apple Podcasts, we'd be so grateful. Well, thank you for considering all the ways you can partner with us. And now back to my conversation with Ann Kennedy about Sarah McCammon's book, The Exvangelicals. Well, not only does she tell her story in this book, in the Ex-Evangelicals, but she also tells other people's stories. So what kind of people does she interview for her book, and how do they describe why they deconstructed from Christianity?
She interviews a variety of people. Some of them she finds, you know, from her work and tracks down and interviews or corresponds with. Others are people that she knows from childhood. There's one person in her class who she interviews from when she was 5 years old, who later came out as gay. And so there's extensive sort of conversation with him. There's not a huge number of people, but they do kind of span the spectrum. One is a Instagram influencer who sort of leads other people through their deconstruction. Another person has an institute or a sort of a ministry for people who feel traumatized by evangelicalism. And there's another person who stopped being a pastor and became a life coach and tries to help people with their deconstructive processes. And she also, she quotes Chrissy Stroop. I found that to be really interesting. He is a person who identifies as a woman, who writes for Religion Dispatches, and is, I found, to be pretty strident online and endorsed Christian Dumais' Jesus and John Wayne. So not quite a very friendly character is Chrissy Stroop. But she finds there's a daughter of a very famous prosperity gospel preacher who she interviews, and they all very much have in common that they had tried to be good Christians or good evangelicals, and it just became too much. The cognitive dissonance was too much, or they felt themselves to be gay. They just couldn't do it, and they gradually began to dismantle their the structure that kind of had held their spiritual Christianity together. And many of them just opt for something else or nothing at all. All of them are affirming, and many of them articulate like feelings of trauma from having grown up as an evangelical.
And when you say all of them are affirming, do you mean that all of them accept just the cultural embrace of the queer worldview?
Yeah, I think they would all say that they affirm LGBTQ plus relationships, and that's probably one of the most important parts of their across the board of their deconstruction, I would say, is that particular issue. And secondarily, I think a political view of Trump or other, you know, more conservative, well, I don't want to say what's conservative and liberal, but Trump is definitely a factor, but it's really the sexuality idea that has alienated an enormous number of people from evangelicalism as we've known it through the decades.
So what are some of the other subjects that she addresses in the book that she wants to talk about as to, you know, issues that are related to deconverting?
She gets into, there's a good chapter on science. It's a substantial chapter on science. And this reminded me a lot of Rachel Held Evans, that she really didn't encounter other views of, that she was taught a sort of BJU, a Becca framework for science and creationism. And so when she encountered evolution and evolutionary theory and those kinds of things, that really kind of knocked her back, because she didn't have a lot to work with intellectually on that score. But then she goes into purity culture at length. She talks about her sexual history, or the lack thereof, before she got married. And she talks about, there's a long chapter on LGBTQ plus relationships, She discusses the Leave Loud movement that was catalyzed by Jamar Tisby. And there's a long chapter about character and the supposed evangelicals' hypocrisy on that score following Trump's election. So she quotes people at length. And then she has a chapter on end times doctrines and those kinds of things. So it's a lot of cultural sort of storytelling, what it was like for her. She got to be a page on Capitol Hill for a semester. And that was really when she was a teenager. That was really when she encountered people of other faiths and got to see Washington a little bit more up close. And that sort of knocked a chink out of her Christian structure. And then there's also a long chapter on corporal punishment and child abuse. And then a chapter about trauma in general and how evangelical beliefs are, and some Orthodox Christian doctrines are traumatic for children, especially to encounter. So it's pretty easy read. And I think if you've encountered any of these kinds of works, if you've read any Rachel Held Evans or Jesus and John Wayne, you'll recognize a lot of the content and the tropes.
It seems that she also, in her talking about not having really had a framework for coming into contact with different things in science like evolution, she also notes that a lot of Christians pulled kids out of public school and they just never had anything beyond exposure to a very maybe narrow, is what she would say, Christian philosophy, because they would just be homeschooled and then go to a Christian school or something like that. So it seems like she just sees Christians as very isolated from the rest of the culture.
Yeah, for sure. She did grow up in a very narrow one kind of Christianity. I don't think she encountered other kinds of Christianity. It doesn't seem like she, you know, knew a lot of other kinds of Protestant or Catholic. She probably never met anybody that was like Greek or Russian Orthodox. I would imagine that her particular church that she grew up in was probably anti-Catholic, although she doesn't necessarily say that. So it was not only one particular doctrinal view, but one cultural view. And she does talk about the fear that her community had for outsiders and that she grew up to be afraid of the world, and that really characterized her growing up. She was able to articulate some of, you know, many points of doctrine and worldview, sort of a worldview education. But as soon as she actually encountered that other world, it crumbled. And so it wasn't very robust. It was strong in the sense that it was all encompassing, but intellectually, it seems like she didn't have the foundation that she needed to encounter, you know, a lot of different kinds of people in the U.S., let alone other parts of the world.
So one of the things she talks about in her book is the fact that people can have trauma over being brought up in certain kind of Christian doctrine. So how does she posit that certain Christian theological truths have actually traumatized both children and then adults because they were exposed to Christian doctrine as children and it caused them trauma that they're dealing with now as an adult?
Yeah, this was the chapter that really surprised me the most because I've read a number of these kinds of books over the last several years. And this is a new kind of take. I have seen a lot of things about trauma in the news and other places like that. But this was the first time where there was sort of a concerted effort that I've read to say that what Christians and evangelicals believe is actually going to damage the psyche of the believer, and that in some cases it would be better if they didn't encounter these ideas because of what it will do to them. And this was really interesting. She quotes somebody who says that what has become more and more apparent to me, this is somebody named Finch, is that the core doctrines and teachings of fundamentalist evangelicalism are extremely traumatic because they distort the way the human psyche would naturally function and thrive. By emphasizing the authority of religious leaders to explain and interpret the world and the intense focus on the afterlife to the exclusion of the present. And in this chapter, she names the, well, discussion of the afterlife and hell. Of course, a lot of people had to suffer through the Left Behind series and had a lot of bad feelings about that. I was one of them. I had to read In the Twinkling of an Eye, which scared me a lot as a child. But I would not say that I was traumatized by it. But anyway, that's one point of trauma for her. And Christian teachings about sexuality and purity, she would count in as traumatic enough that it causes real psychic harm. And then just a basic teaching about hell lasting forever, and the idea that you could be a sinner, somebody who was by nature sinful, not only somebody who commits sins, but somebody who's by nature sinful, would be deeply traumatizing and need some kind of redress. And so there are institutes and ministries that are sort of popping up to help ex-evangelicals deal with having heard these messages. Something like, a lot of them don't feel safe, they say. And it's interesting because it's not just, you know, most discussion about trauma is that you encounter some kind of traumatic event. But even that on its own is not enough to cause trauma. It's how you interact or experience that event. So two people could experience the same event and only one of them would come away with trauma. And so it's how so it's not every single person who grows up in evangelical is going to be traumatized by that, but the possibility is there in how you engage with that through your sense perceptions and your emotional life is going to either make you be traumatized or not. So in the chapter, they also, you know, just the encountering contradictions in a religion could produce trauma. And then she even includes something called financial trauma, which is the constant expectation in many churches to give financially, and even at times of financial stress. So it's a long chapter. All the chapters are not very long, but this is one of the longer ones. And I thought that it was really interesting. So I wouldn't have said that people who grew up evangelical really grew up traumatized. You know, there are a lot of different systems of thought and belief that can mess you up. But I wouldn't have said that evangelicalism in the 80s and 90s was one of those things. So I was very interested in this chapter.
It's interesting that she is couching it in that way. The only other person I've heard of talking about Christian doctrine being very harmful to children is years ago. I'm talking maybe, I don't know, 15 years, 20 years ago. I heard an interview, probably on NPR with, and I say that because I listened to a lot of NPR at the time for work reasons, just to see what people were talking about and doing. And one of those interviews was with Richard Dawkins. And he talked about that it was tantamount to child abuse to expose children to teachings like the idea of sin and hell. And that would be very, I don't think he used the word trauma because that's a more recent word that has taken on new meanings in terms of the classic view of what trauma is, or explanation to encompass a whole bunch of different things. But that's the only other time I've heard it. But You mentioned earlier that she found out later as she got older that maybe the reason behind why they were praying for her grandfather. So her relationship with her parents and her grandfather played into kind of just this whole experience that she had. And I wonder, did she ever say that she actually believed this, or she just was felt like she had been pressured to believe it? And so tell me about those two things. You know, talk a little bit about her relationship with her parents and her grandfather a little bit more when he came out. And then also, do you think she actually ever really believed in Christianity at all?
I don't think that, just judging from the book itself, that she ever really believed. I think she tried to, or she assumed that she did. And then as things kind of came apart, she describes at one point in being in high school and having really serious doubts and a teacher sitting down with her and explaining that she doesn't really need to worry because she is elect and so God is going to take care of her. But of course that kind of exacerbated things because she was worried about other people and not necessarily herself. And so she was worried about her grandfather. So the idea that she was elect didn't comfort her at that point. And I'm sure it was expressed, you know, probably without a lot of depth, it sounded like. Well, I don't know. You can't tell the degree to which her narration of the people in her life is really fair, I would say, because she's kind of the good person. So, and her community and her parents are not actually villains, but they kind of function as that in the narrative. And so her strained relationship with them comes through again and again. She even puts in letters that her mother wrote her. She describes, you know, the painful conversations that they had about her grandfather when she was an adult. And so she went and sought out her grandfather and told him that she accepted him. And I think, you know, it wasn't, her parents wanted her grandfather, which he respected, not to say anything about his lifestyle until their kids were older and they could have more frame of reference for it. But it seems that that essentially backfired because she found out and, you know, she viewed him as persecuted by her family. And it seems like he sort of accepted that place as a person who had been treated poorly by her family. And so she took his side. It was really in a kind of, you know, an emotional, one might say, family systems kind of thing, where there are deep problems in the family and they haven't been redressed and people don't really know how to get along with each other in a human sense, even before you add theology in. But of course, it has a veneer of theology over the whole thing, or at least culture. And so she took his part. And then later, she divorced her husband, you know, after about 16 years of marriage. And so that drew her closer to her grandfather as well, because he was really supportive of her and her parents. That just further alienated her from them. And so I don't know. I mean, she tried going, she's sort of in this like seeking posture, you know, she's gone to an Episcopal church. She might call herself a Christian, but essentially it seems like she never encountered a real experience with Jesus, that one that I would recognize that would sort of count as an actual Christian faith commitment or call or anything like that.
Does she address anything about feeling ashamed of having grown up in this kind of Christian culture? And also, does she address any other kind of issues associated with the trope of evangelicalism? Specifically, her subtitle is Leaving the White Evangelical Church. So is she saying that evangelicals are specifically white, middle-class folks in America? And I will tell our listeners this. I don't know where I saw it recently, But I think in American culture, the idea of evangelicalism has been very influenced by certain Protestant denominations that are very large. And the Christian church is, you know, like you said, made up of various traditions and so forth. And that denomination is the Southern Baptist denomination, which has certain, you know, approach to its faith that's been viewed culturally. And I think the latest figure I saw was something like 14 million members. They have almost 14 million, like 13.9 million members of the Southern Baptist Convention. So that's interesting because you and I go to more like confessional, liturgical, Christian traditions. And the tradition that I'm a part of as a Reformed Presbyterian, not mainline, I mean, I think our membership's around 300,000 or something like that. I'm talking about membership people who say, yes, I'm a member kind of thing. So there's all kinds of other people that attend Southern Baptist, Anglican, or churches in my communion that, you know, aren't official members or something. But so I think that whole entire left behind kind of purity culture, I mean, growing up, that wasn't even my experience. I didn't even hear about that, I don't think, the whole purity culture thing, until I had graduated from college. So she probably grew up in a certain kind of culture herself. And did that bring about some shame or embarrassment and just kind of this identification that makes her cringe?
Yeah, I think that shame is a big part of the narrative and embarrassment. And she doesn't really bring it up, but I really feel like there's an underlying class issue between her parents and her grandfather. You know, I think she would probably consider him to be more elite status, that he's more intellectual, he's has better taste. She just talks about how beautiful his house is and not much about her own house. So her parents seems, I think, are in a charismatic, or were in a charismatic church. And so just across sort of American demographics, I think there are definitely class and culture issues that are at the heart somewhat of, I mean, of course, you can't discount the theology, but I think leaving her, she calls it a bubble, her evangelical bubble, and encountering a world that isn't probably, for her, lowbrow, you know, I think there's that's one driver against purity culture, is that it's embarrassing, it's cringe, it's, you know, Midwestern, low class. You know, maybe that you have a lot of money, but you don't have a lot of status. You certainly don't have any elite status in terms of the larger culture. You don't really speak to the larger issues of the day. And it seems like that was the world that she grew up in. So it gives you BJU, a BECA curriculum in Christian schools. I mean, I grew up with a BECA curriculum, and it's sort of prosaic, you know, it gets the job done kind of thing. It's definitely not highbrow. It's not intellectual, or at least it wasn't back in the 80s. So it feels like she was embarrassed to be kind of low class, or and I really think that the word white is kind of thrown in there as a class marker, as well as a political marker, rather than an actual theological or even a real cultural indicator of the differences between American Christians. Because of course the Black church is a whole phenomenon in America. Many people have written about, and they're like really faithful, you know, almost exclusively Black ethnic churches in the U.S. that are evangelical, that, you know, I would say politically might fall in under the white evangelical moniker if you examined their beliefs, or what, you know, Sarah McCammon would end up thinking about them, because they're not affirming, you know, they might be anti-abortion. You know, even the Black ethnic church across America is not a monolith. You couldn't just say, you know, Black Christianity in America and be able to meaningfully speak about it. And so it's a really cheap way to signal your shame about having grown up in that world. It's just not the ascendant world. It's not a place that has any cultural cachet with anyone today. And, you know, as a person who works for NPR, she just really doesn't want to be associated, I think, with those kind of people. And so that's really the thing that comes through the strongest for me in her writing. She's a very good writer, but the sense of shame and embarrassment is uppermost.
And it seems to me from just things you're saying that she just lumps all evangelicals into being kind of non-thinking, and not just non-thinking, but even anti-intellectual, perhaps.
Yes, she says that at one point, that, you know, she, well, at least the world that she grew up in was anti-intellectual, and she sort of uses the word fundamentalist, evangelical, several times, and without defining really either of those terms. So yeah, she just does a broad sweeping accusation of anti-intellectualism against, you know, again, white evangelicals. This is a huge swath of people. And yes, statistically, most of them are Southern Baptists, but even in Southern Baptist churches, there's a huge range between, you know, small mega church, you know, some really probably very thoughtful congregations, and some that are just, you know, more, you know, have a different ethos. So it is, I find, is a pretty lazy way to look at an entire demographic of people in the U.S.
So one of the things that you mentioned early on was, in particular, former President Donald Trump, who's actually running again now, it's 2024, for president. But she talks about politics being a big factor for ex-evangelicals like herself. And probably, I don't know, it depends on the age of our listeners, but this was before my time. You know, I was of voting age at the time when the Moral Majority was founded back in the 70s by Jerry Falwell. And at that time, I think that was really when conservative evangelical Christians, and in particular the Republican Party, kind of joined forces. And so now this mixing of people who were identifying themselves as evangelical or as Christians, or quote unquote born again, if anyone remembers that phrase from Jimmy Carter, actually, who wasn't a Republican in the 70s, that was kind of that whole identification of being born again and associated with a particular political party. And then over the years, the decades, it's continued with, you know, a lot of Christians or evangelicals identifying with a specific party. And so I think in the media and in culture, people kind of put them together, especially people who don't know anything about Christianity. They assume that Christianity is also somehow tied to certain political parties and views. So how do politics, in particular, at this juncture in 2024, in this time period, really factor in for ex-evangelicals? Because I don't think that there was as much of a move in the past with kids that had grown up in a religious household who are now rejecting it, and politics, as there is now, perhaps?
Yeah, I think people have always been leaving the church for, you know, a variety of reasons, and doing something else, you know, like becoming a Buddhist, or, I mean, a lot of people, I grew up in, you know, I went to a boarding school, a conservative Baptist boarding school. So there's quite a large number of people who left the school and did not continue to believe, or didn't believe in God while they were there and were open about it. But then, you know, some of my classmates, you know, came out as Buddhist and, you know, traveled the world and did other things and just didn't really think about it. You know, they were happy to leave the faith of their childhood behind, and they didn't then identify as anything sort of in contradistinction to that. But it does seem like with the rise of Trump, it's important to a certain set of people who grew up in the evangelical world, because he was elected by, I mean, I was looking it up today, it seems like Catholics, Mormons, and evangelicals helped put him in the White House. And so I don't know if there's an ex-Catholic movement based on Catholic votes for Trump, but it is definitely a thing for evangelicals. And that need to distinguish oneself from a certain religious voting bloc is just uppermost. It's essential, it seems like, for this group that's trying to form itself. And I think that's really interesting. I know a lot of people who've both voted for Trump and also, you know, on the other side, who really, really don't like him at all and would never vote for him. So who go to the same churches. So it's interesting. Yeah, you know, there's a need to categorize everybody as one kind of thing. And I think scapegoat them rather than looking at the variety of reasons that people did vote and not vote in 2016 and 2020. But this is definitely a politically motivated, I don't even know if it's a movement. I've been calling it a movement, but I don't know how well organized it is. I think it's a word that people claim, but they don't gather for worship, or, you know, they find each other online, really, is what happens. It's not like an alternate religion or anything like that. So it is curious. I mean, I think at some point the way people are talking about evangelicals and politics, they're going to talk about ex-evangelicals and politics, because it's ironically still a deeply political thing. And I would say even more so than for actual evangelicals. That's my sense. I could totally be wrong, but I would say a lot of evangelicals probably voted and then went back and continued on with their religious life, whereas this seems like it's really oriented around election time and particular political beliefs.
Well, she critiques evangelicalism, and I want to ask you, are there critiques that are fair of evangelicalism and various Christian subcultures? I know here at the Christian Research Institute, we have looked into some of those things. And if our listeners don't know, a long time ago, now we're almost 400 episodes, hundreds of episodes ago, we talked about the term sexual purity, and we critiqued the purity movement. There is an article that we have on our website called "Should We Continue to Use the Term Sexual Purity?" because it was so identified with the whole purity movement that had some very misguided views and twisting of scripture and how they used it. And so we have done that ourselves. So we definitely do. If people have been following us in more than 45 years of our existence, we have critiqued various movements and thinking within Christianity itself. And so what kind of critique is fair of evangelicalism? And does she get anything right in that regard?
I don't think really the critiques that she offers are helpful, because, I mean, she's left the church. And why she thinks she did that, I think, of course, she has her own explanation for that. But reading between the lines, I would say that you can definitely see where things went wrong. And there are some cautionary points. I think it's definitely past time for evangelicals to consider how they catechize their children. And I would say even the intellectual depth of the curriculum they use and Sunday school material and, you know, depth of preaching in the pulpit. I've been saying for years that a lot of evangelicals and Baptists in particular say that they believe the Bible and they trust the Bible. But if you go to many churches, you won't actually hear a sermon on the Bible. You won't hear an actual exposition of the text in such a way that people can go later and, you know, derive meaning from it on their own and be helped by that. So I think there's a really almost a crisis of preaching, I would say, in many corners of evangelicalism. Of course, there's some notable and wonderful Bible exegetes and preachers in many, many different traditions around the U.S. But I would say they, in some cases, kind of prove the rule of it being, of needing more emphasis in that area. And then another point where I think the church is faltering is that we have gone in heavily for apologetic worldview discussions without creating a way of life for Christians, for children. We have, you know, sort of strong communities and support networks, but those are often of the mind. They're not, it's just the sort of habits of life that make, and the pleasures of life in a godly and Christian way that have been historically available to people have not been used by evangelicals over the last many years. It's been, you know, the rhythms of the church year and the church through the ages were abandoned for a variety of reasons. And I think that was to the detriment of children in particular, who then, of course, grow up to be adults. And I think that the general approach, how evangelicals have thought about childhood and childhood faith, and to some degree, even adult faith, has been not fully formed. And a lot was taken for granted, I think, because I think the idea that we lived in a Christian culture and that kids would be able, if you brought them up in a certain kind of way, they would then go out into the world and be fine. Those assumptions turned out to be wrong. So I do think there's a lot to be worked on for evangelicals about the kind of the way of life, the kind of teaching. I would say not the actual doctrinal content. That's something I think she would say needs to be jettisoned. But I would say it's not the content. It's the way that it, either its depth, but also the manner in which it was presented and the way that people lived it out in their lives, that really does need some very thoughtful work. And in that, I'm grateful for these kinds of testimonials, as it were, because I think it's really important for Christians to see where things go wrong in somebody's life in the church as a child and as they grow up. And it's heartbreaking to see, but if you get a chance to look at it, I think people can make other decisions. You know, they can decide to live different ways. They can maybe go to different churches. They can think about it and make choices that will ultimately benefit, you know, generations to come.
And hopefully parents would know, if there's parents listening to this and thinking about, you know, even if they have kids that have deconverted adult children, that they would know that, you know, we strive to live as God has called us as parents, but really it is in terms of embracing and believing these doctrinal truths of the Word of God up to the power of the Holy Spirit at work in a child. Because I was reading somebody's biography recently who was a deeply religious mother, and it was just so interesting to me. This person could, who's a really well-known celebrity, I mean, they have very much respect for their parent, and they were taken to three different kinds of churches every Sunday, and their mother's a deeply religious person, and yet they just don't believe in it at all, not intellectually or anything, and yet they very much grew up in the church and actually have a great relationship with their parent, with their mother, who's deeply religious. So I want to encourage parents that, you know, it's really God at work too, so that, but you do raise your children up in the church. And I would say one critique could be said that we see very much the Christian Research Institute is a lot of Christians really don't know what they believe, or for that matter, why they even believe it. So it is good for people to, you know, be strong doctrinally and be equipped, but also to know that it's not just to believe these things, but how does that live out? How do you live Christianly? How do you have a Christian worldview?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I haven't met very many believers lately who were too well informed for the task of their Christian life. I think we can all really delve more deeply into a faith that is so rich and deep and broad, and just not keep those mysteries and those essential truths from each other and from children in particular. Because I think it's when we really encounter the truth in its depth and its beauty that it's so compelling at a young age in particular. So I think that's absolutely true.
And I will point our listeners to various podcasts that Anne and I have done on the church. I think we did one last year on the church calendar where we talked about some of these issues, because I think a lot of, you know, quote unquote, pop evangelicals over the years really haven't been connected or don't have a robust ecclesiology to understand what it means to be a part of the life of the church. Now, some people do. I mean, you mentioned the Black church. There is very much a, you know, a commitment to church in that space in Americanism. But a lot of, you know, what you would call white evangelicals have just been pretty much more personal driven in terms of their faith versus life in the church. And so, you know, we could talk about this for a long time, but why that's all important too. I'm not saying that she didn't go to church or that her life wasn't in the church, but just a variety of different things. And that's why I hope this podcast for our listeners encourages people, because we do. The reason why we cover cultural apologetics and all these kinds of things is that we want people to be thoughtful, to know what's out there, to be able to know how Christianity does answer all of these questions and all the questions that, you know, Sarah McCammon had. There are answers for those from the Word of God. Well, on a much lighter note than people deconverting, I recently got back from a trip overseas. So, Anne, would you rather have a vacation overseas or just something domestic, just in the United States?
Oh, wow. That's a hard choice. I mean, I would hate to choose because I love to travel. Last year at this time, I was in Kenya. I was looking at Mount Kilimanjaro today last year. So that was amazing. But I also do love to camp here at home. So whatever I have money for, that's what I end up doing.
Not choosing a specific one. Well, thanks, Anne, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. This was great.
You've been listening to episode 389 of the Postmodern Realities podcast. Today's guest was Anne Kennedy. She has written a book review for us. It's called Fear, Loathing, and Deconverting from the White Evangelical Church, a review of the Exvangelicals by Sarah McCammon. You can read her book review for free at our website, equip.org. You won't want to miss out on subscribing to the other podcasts from the Christian Research Institute. We have the Bible Answer Man podcast, which is published Monday through Friday with the best of the week on Saturday. It's hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and is available wherever you get your favorite podcasts. In addition, Hank has a podcast called Hank Unplugged. Hank takes you out of the studio and into his study to engage in free-flowing, essential Christian conversations on critical issues with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people on the planet. And you won't want to miss out on the brand new podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Christian Research Journal Reads presents audio versions of Christian Research Journal articles. It was a print incarnation of almost 45 years. It's now on the web, as you know, with new articles every single week. So you won't want to miss these audio articles of some of our most popular and most accessed articles on our website, equip.org.